thank you all for coming, first of all. And it's a great privilege to be doing this. It's a great privilege, first of all, to be giving a retreat, talking about what I'm going to be talking about, and especially at the start of, Palm Sunday weekend, because what I'll be talking about is, in many ways, the Jewish context of Jesus and the Jewish context of the passion and death of Jesus. And it's what I tend to talk about and what I'm all about, and I'll start with my witness testimony, which will make it a little bit more evident, is the continuation of Judaism into the Catholic Church and the way they're really two parts of the same story that are divided by the central event in creation history, which is the incarnation of God as man, and the point in time where one can see the first half of salvation history being transformed in the second half of transition of salvation history is in fact the Last Supper, which is simultaneously a Passover Seder, in other words, a Jewish sacramental event, the last Jewish sacramental event, and the first Catholic Mass, the first Catholic sacramental event. So it's a great privilege to be doing this around that time and in preparation for Holy Week and Good Friday and Easter. But rather than get too far ahead of myself, I'll start with my witness testimony, and that also will serve as a way of introducing myself. But I'll first introduce myself. My name is Roy Shoman, and I am, as you may have guessed, from the United States. And I teach theology at a Catholic university in the United States, Ave Maria University, and also at a Catholic seminary, Holy Apostle Seminary. But let me start with my witness testimony. I am Jewish. Let me rephrase that. I consider that I still am Jewish, and I'll talk about that, but I was baptized into the Catholic Church in 1992, so I'm definitely also Catholic. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'll say the reason I say I am Jewish rather than I was Jewish was because, as far as I can tell, if I was Jewish for the first half of my life, and then I became a follower of the Jewish Messiah, who is Jesus, why did I stop being Jewish by being a Jew who followed the Jewish Messiah? Right? It should have made me more Jewish than ever. So, which is the way I see it, but anyway. So I was born and raised Jewish. My parents are both German-Jewish Holocaust refugees. They were both born and raised in Germany. My father left Germany immediately after Hitler came to power. There was a short period when he was actually encouraging the Jews to leave. My mother's family was less fortunate. They fled to France, but France didn't last long. And she was actually arrested by the Gestapo and put on a train to a concentration camp, but she escaped while the train was still in France. The French bureaucrats aren't nearly as efficient as the German bureaucrats, for, you know, much to her benefit and mine. And she managed to make it to the United States, where my parents met and married. And growing up, our whole world was Jewish. All my parents' friends were Jewish. Where we lived, in those days, there was more separation. And there was much less mingling between, between ethnic groups. And so all my friends were Jewish growing up. And we were also quite religious, religious Jews. And I went to Jewish religious education all the way from the beginning of school until university. I went to MIT, which is a technical university in the United States, engineering and science, and I lost my faith there, primarily under the influence of the scientific arrogance and pseudoscientific worldview that religion is just a sort of medieval superstition that man believed in before science came up with all the answers, and anything that science doesn't have the answer to today, it will in 5 years. Which in fact is not at all a scientific worldview. It's a pseudoscientific view, because the essence of science is that you start with the data, you start with the evidence, and you form a theory that explains the evidence. And if the theory fails to explain the evidence, you have to throw away the theory and come up with another theory that does explain the evidence. and all of the evidence is in favor of the Catholic faith. There's lots of very materialistic scientific evidence supporting the Catholic faith and contradicting materialism, such as the medical miracles at Lourdes, the miracle at Fatima that was seen by 70 to 100,000 people, including skeptics and communists and atheists who saw the sun spin in the sky and crash to earth. The Shroud of Turin, which even with all of the science and engineering of today, no one could even hope to counterfeit or simulate. The Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which there's no natural explanation for, and there are many miraculous aspects to that and so forth. So in fact, all of the scientific evidence is in favor of the Catholic Church, and the view that science disproves the faith is actually the opposite of science, because it's a theory that's held in the face of the evidence, not that it's supported by the evidence. G.K. Chesterton has a very appropriate quote, which is, "Rightly or wrongly, those who believe in miracles do so on the basis of the evidence, and rightly or wrongly, those who disbelieve in miracles refuse to believe in them on the basis of faith." So anyway, but I didn't know this, and I lost my faith at university. I went on to Harvard Business School, and I did well enough there that they invited me back to join the faculty. So at the ripe old age of 29, I found myself a newly minted professor of marketing at Harvard Business School. And that's really where my witness testimony begins. Because what had been happening was that all my life since I was a small child, I thought I knew there had to be a real meaning and purpose to life. And I thought that when I was older, I would come into the real meaning and purpose of life, which I thought would come from entering into a personal relationship with God, which I honestly thought would happen at my bar mitzvah. The bar mitzvah is roughly analogous to Catholic confirmation. When the child is about 13 years old, he has a ceremony in the synagogue where he enters into religious adulthood. And I really thought that at my bar mitzvah, I would come into personal knowledge of God. And when that didn't happen, it was actually one of the saddest days of my childhood. But then pretty soon I decided the real meaning and purpose of life would come when I got a driver's license. Or when I began university, or if I got into Harvard Business School, or when I began my career, or so forth. But here I was more successful in my secular career than I ever expected to be, being a professor at Harvard. But life still had no meaning or purpose. But at this point, there was nothing more I could look forward to that I might imagine would give life meaning. So I actually fell into the deepest despair of my life because, you know, I really believed the materialistic view that life was just an accident and we were just the product of evolution and we were on Earth for 80 or 90 years and then we died and that was it and so forth. There was no pattern to anything and so forth. So I was in this existential despair. And it was in that mood I was walking in nature early one morning in some low pine woods just in from a beach near where I lived when I received the most spectacular grace of my life. I was just walking along, lost in my thoughts. I had long since given up any real hope of believing in God. When, from one moment to the next, the veil between earth and heaven disappeared, and I found myself in the presence of God, very knowingly in the presence of God, seeing my life as though I had died, and I was looking back over my life in the presence of God. And I saw in an instant how I would feel about everything after I died. I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be, number one, all of the time and energy I had wasted worrying about not being loved when every moment of my existence I was held in an ocean of love, greater than I ever imagined could exist, coming from an all-knowing, all-loving God. And the other great regret would be every hour that I had wasted doing nothing of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that every moment of our existence has the potential for moral action that is observed and recorded and matters for all eternity. And if we take advantage of that opportunity, we will very literally be rewarded for that for all eternity. And if we let that moment go by and don't take advantage of it, it will be a missed opportunity for all eternity. I saw, I mean, I saw in some sense, I saw everything in that experience, a whole world of theology. I'll just mention a little more that comes to mind. I saw how foolish I had been living my life, sort of in the rear view mirror, saying to myself, if only that hadn't happened, then I would be happy today. Or if only that hadn't happened, then I would be happy today. That nothing could be further from the truth, that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged, coming from the hands of an all-knowing, all-loving God. Not only including those things that had caused the most suffering at the time, but especially those things that had caused the most suffering at the time that I had thought of as the greatest disasters at the time. The most overwhelming single aspect of this experience was coming into the immediate knowledge that God had controlled everything that happened to me, but more than that, that he had been looking over me and aware of me and connected to me every moment of my existence and caring about me as though I were the only creature he had ever created. And that he not only controlled everything that happened to me, but he knew how I felt at every moment and cared about how I felt at every moment. And in some sense was made sad by everything that made me sad and was happy at everything that made me happy. That was the single most overwhelming aspect of this experience. I'll mention a couple of other things. One is, I was not surprised when this was happening that I was seeing heaven. The only thing I was surprised at was that I could ever have not seen it. It was so much more immediate and substantial and real than the physical world around me, which I still saw, by the way, that I just could not wrap my mind around the fact that I could ever have not seen it. And I never imagined that I could ever be blind to it again. It was just so much realer than the physical world. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but what it was a little bit like was sometimes if one goes to the theater, you know, before the ballet or the play starts, the house lights will be on and there'll be an opaque curtain in front of the stage. And then the house lights will go down and there'll be light shining on the front of the curtain and it'll still be opaque. And then they dim those lights and they turn on the stage lights behind the curtain. And all of a sudden you can see through the curtain and it just becomes this almost like transparent gauze and you can see what's happening on the stage. And that's what this was like. It was like the physical world was that transparent curtain, and behind it, the spiritual world was that much realer and even more physical. And I saw, this is incidental, but I actually also saw the angelic hierarchies going up and up and up, and that the like circles of angels, I'm almost embarrassed to tell this, but like circles of angels with the base, like an upside down funnel. So the base was many, and then at each level it became fewer and more exalted and fewer and more exalted and fewer and more exalted, kind of funneling upwards. And disappearing into the light that was the Godhead. And anyway, I also saw, of course, how foolish I had been worrying about life having no meaning when it had an infinite depth of meaning. Every moment had a potential of doing something of value in the eyes of heaven that would matter for all eternity. I saw how stupid I had been working all my life for things that wouldn't do me any good even 100 years from then after I was dead. When, if I wanted, well, I saw that I had been stupidly selfish working for things that wouldn't matter even 100 years later. If I wanted to be smart and selfish, the only thing that made sense was to try to be as great a saint as possible, to essentially work for things that very literally would be benefiting me 100 million years from now. I know that's not the right attitude. I mean, you know. But I will, in my defense, I'll say, first of all, that at the time I was a professor of marketing at Harvard Business School. So everything was, you know, cash flow analysis, net present value, maximizing returns. And I just saw that I had been stupid. I had been maximizing the wrong returns. It had been as though I was working all my life for Monopoly money, you know, that brightly painted paper, colored paper, when right next to it there were these solid gold coins. You know, I could have been greedily hoarding instead. So I, of course, saw the meaning and purpose of my life was to worship and serve my Lord and Master and God who was revealing himself to me. What I didn't know was his name and what religion to follow. I couldn't think of him as the God of Judaism that I had grown up with. I now know that, of course, it was, strictly speaking, the God of Judaism. But in all honesty, if you read the Old Testament, the picture of God that emerges is of a God far more distant and severe and judgmental than this God was. And I'll talk about this more probably later this weekend, but it's not just because the picture the Jews had was different, it's because the relationship between God and man was different before the incarnation. There's a passage in Joel chapter 3, which goes something like, the day will come that you won't have to ask people to tell you about God because I'll make myself known to the lowest maidservant and manservant. And that passage is, by the way, quoted by Peter in Acts when he, on Pentecost Sunday, that the, you know, that basically the coming of Christ was the fulfillment of that prophecy, that all of a sudden God wasn't distant, but he did make himself known to every person of goodwill. But in the Old Testament, if you read the Old Testament, God only spoke through the prophets and the priests. He did not speak to ordinary people. And there's a very strong image in Exodus when Moses was going to go up on top of Mount Sinai to receive the Ten Commandments. God told him, before you come up Mount Sinai, have a fence built around the base of the mountain to protect, to keep anyone from approaching the base of the mountain. Because if any of the people should even touch the base of the mountain while I'm on top, they'll have to be immediately killed for the sacrilege. So that was the picture of God I had, which certainly wasn't this God who was leaning over me all of my life with his ear to my lips, so to speak, to hear the faintest, you know, murmur of my concern or my heart or my prayer or whatever. So I prayed to know who he was so I would know what religion to follow. And I prayed, I was still walking at the time, by the way. I could still see, as I said, the physical world around me. I could also see, it was an extremely neat experience. I could actually also, it was really wonderful. I saw the way all of nature was worshiping God in their own way. The kind of the unity in nature between the insects and the plants and the sunlight. And how basically all of creation in their own way was joining in the kind of worship of God. But anyway, so I prayed to know the name of this God who was my Lord and Master so I would know what religion to follow. And I prayed as I was walking, let me know your name so I know what religion to follow to worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Krishna and I have to become Hindu. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian. And I very literally pray that. It's another story, but I think you can understand where that came from. The Jews, by and large, have a sense, very strong sense of Christ, Christianity being the enemy, and therefore Jesus being the enemy, and sort of that Jesus was this false Messiah that started this cult of Christianity, which was then the source of the suffering of the Jews for the next 2,000 years and so forth. So that's where that was coming from. I will say, it's a little bit of a digression, but there are two other elements to that resistance to Christ, which I felt at the time that I'm very aware of now. One is that I frankly always knew, from when I was a small child, I always felt a truth to Christianity, and I also always felt a presence of Jesus as a small child. And, you know, around Christmas time when I would see Christmas trees or hear Christmas carols, and I was very drawn to the infant Jesus, who I kind of felt around that. But then I was taught that he's not for you, of course. So it became a kind of sour grapes, you know, like Aesop's fables, where something you want is not for you, so you turn into kind of hatred of it or, resentment of it and so forth. And there was actually another element to it, too, which is that Jesus stands at the door and knocks, and if you're Jewish, you don't want to let him in. So it's sort of like you hear the faint knocking, so you push the dresser against the door, but there's knocking still there, so you push the bed against the door, and eventually you have all the furniture in the room pushed against the door because, you know, you're afraid of this knocking on the other side. So that was a big part of it also. And now looking back, I can see all of that. But anyway, so I prayed to know his name as long as it wasn't Christ, and so he didn't tell me his name. But I went back home. The experience was very slow to fade, by the way. It lasted for 3 or 4 hours before it faded. I mean, it started fading maybe after about an hour and a half. It started fading when I came across other people, actually. And in the beginning, when I came across other people, I could actually hear their thoughts. But with each, I know you do that at the table, right? But anyway, with each person, I kind of dropped a little bit. This consciousness dropped a little bit. So by the time, it was getting later in the morning, and I was walking towards the beach where there were more people. So by the time I had passed 10 or 12 people, it had largely faded. I went back home, you know, happy since childhood. I knew it was all true. I knew we lived forever. I knew there was a reason to be good. I knew that every moment, you know, had infinite depth of meaning. I knew that there was never any reason to be anxious about anything, that absolutely everything that happened, everything that comes to meet us is the most perfect thing that could be arranged. That, of course, doesn't mean that our response to it is the most perfect thing, because we sin. But what's so wonderful is God, I don't want to get controversial, but God knows before we sin exactly what we're going to do with that thing that comes to meet us. And therefore, he's designed that thing to come to meet us already around what he knows we're going to do. So that's why all things work to the good for those who love God, because those circumstances, even when we respond to them wrong, in a wrong way, God sent them to us knowing we would respond to them in a wrong way and planning for the greater good through our incorrect response or through our sinful response. But anyway, so I went back home happy for the first time since childhood, and all I wanted to do was find out who this God was and how to worship and serve him properly, and if possible to repeat the experience. I had no idea that it would never be repeated. And I quickly lost interest in teaching Harvard MBAs how to make a little bit more money. And I was just really spending all my time and energy pursuing this. Now, it had been a mystical experience, and what you do when you have a mystical experience and you want to find more about it, you find a mystic to talk to, which wasn't a very prudent thing to do in a university town in the 1980s, and is never a very prudent thing to do. And I went to see a self-styled mystic, who filled my arms with all kinds of unhealthy books and my head with a lot of unhealthy ideas, and actually tried to get me involved in his kind of guru-based Hindu meditation group and so forth. So I wasted about 6 months kind of looking into those avenues. But there was one smart thing I did after I got home from that experience too, which was every night before I went to sleep, I would say a short prayer that I had made up to know the name of my Lord and God and Master who had revealed himself to me that day. And a year to the day after the initial experience, and I know that it was exactly a year because I remember I prayed before going to sleep in thanksgiving for what had happened a year earlier. I went to sleep. I thought I was woken by a hand gently on my shoulder, and led to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman I could ever imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And when I found myself in her presence, all I wanted to do was throw myself on my knees and somehow honor her appropriately. In fact, the first thought that crossed my mind was, oh my gosh, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. But I didn't. So, let me kind of back up and say two things. I now know that my body was asleep, and if there was a camera in the room, it would have shown my body asleep in bed during this experience. While the experience was going on, I thought I was awake. I thought it was a waking experience. And the way my memory represents it is as though I was awake. And the way I remember the, you know, word for word, the conversation, and I'll go into some other details. I even remember, you know, what I was thinking about the time and so forth. So subjectively, it felt like a totally waking experience, but I now know that objectively, you know, my body was asleep in bed at the time. So anyway, when I found myself in her presence, I was lifted into a state of ecstasy greater than I ever imagined could exist just from the love that flowed from her. And as overwhelming as her physical beauty was in appearance, even more overwhelming was the sound of her voice and the way that her voice was kind of simultaneously, you know, like the essence of music. It's not that she was singing, but it carried something that was like the essence of music and pure love at the same time, and it just, you know, passed through me and lifted me up into this ecstasy. And the first thing she said to me was that she offered to answer any questions I might have for her. Now, I wanted to ask her to teach me the Hail Mary, but I was too proud to admit that I didn't know it. So instead, as a kind of indirect way, I asked her what her favorite prayer to her was. Figuring that then she would teach me the Hail Mary. But her initial response was somewhat coy. It was, "I love all prayers" to me. But I was a little bit pushy. Maybe that's because I'm a New York Jew, and maybe not. But I said, "But you must love some prayers to you more than others." And she relented, and she recited a prayer, but it was in Portuguese, and I didn't know any Portuguese. So all I could do was make the effort to remember the first few syllables phonetically. And the next morning when I woke up, I wrote them down phonetically. And then later when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all of the Marian prayers in Portuguese so that I could identify it. And to the best of my ability, the prayer was, "O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse to thee." I asked her about four or five other questions. I remember the feeling of standing there weighing different questions in my mind. What about this one? No, that's stupid. What about this one? Okay, I'll ask that one, and so forth. And I'll mention a couple of them now. Most of the questions were motivated by being overwhelmed by her presence. And so at one point I kind of stammered out, "How is it possible? How can it be? How is it possible that you're so magnificent, that you're so exalted, that you're so glorious? How can it be?" And she just looked down at me almost pityingly and shook her head gently, and she said, "Oh no, you don't understand. You don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything." And by the way, I knew nothing. I mean, I knew nothing about the Blessed Virgin Mary at the time of this experience. I had never even touched a New Testament for fear of being polluted, much less opened one. And all I knew about, you know, about Christianity or about Mary was what, you know, like passing creches occasionally at Christmas and overhearing Christmas carols. And that line in Silent Night, "Round Young Virgin," I thought referred to the fact that she was pregnant and she was a round young virgin. That's how little I knew. So all of this was new to me, to say the least. But out of this desire to honor her appropriately, I also asked her what title she liked best for herself. And her answer was, "I am the beloved daughter of the Father, mother of the Son, and spouse of the Spirit." Now, by now I figured out, of course, that this was about Christianity and it had been Christ on the beach, and I'd better get up to speed pretty quickly. And all my life I had heard the expression the Holy Spirit, but I had no idea what it meant, and I didn't even know that he was a person. So I apologize for the way I asked this question, but it's the way I phrased it. I said, "What's this business about the Holy Spirit?" And her response was just to look upwards with an expression melting with love and say, "He's his gaze." So I asked her a couple of more questions, including a really stupid one, which I'll never tell anyone. It's a long story. But anyway, and then after the questions and answers, she said she had something she wanted to speak to me about, and she spoke to me for about another 10 or 12 minutes. Now, there's a veil over that second part of the experience where she was speaking to me, and I have a vague sense of what she was speaking to me about, but I don't have anything like the kind of word-for-word clear memory that I have of the questions and answers. I know that that second thing of what she was telling me was kind of, in some sense, planting something in me that would unfold in time that I would become aware of at the right time. But it was kind of a lifetime of seeds that would, sprout at the right time. And anyway, so then the audience is over, and I'll tell the truth. What ended the audience was that I began to worship her. I couldn't help it. And when I started, my heart kind of made the transition into a kind of gesture of worship. She kind of shyly withdrew. She, was kind of like almost like embarrassedly, like, she had to leave. And in my defense, I'll say, we know in both the Old Testament and the New Testament, whenever anyone found themselves in the presence of an angel, like St. John, I think it's in his letter, it's either in Revelation or in his letter, when he found himself in the presence of an angel, he fell down on his face and began to worship the angel until the angel said, "Get up, that's not appropriate, I'm a creature like you." And we know that the Blessed Virgin Mary is the Queen of Angels, so she's more exalted than the most exalted of the angels. So, that's the normal human response to how glorious an angel is, how much more so to the Queen of Angels. But anyway, so the audience ended. I went back to sleep. The next morning when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ in that earlier experience. And I knew that I wanted nothing other than to be as fully and completely a Christian as possible. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the difference between a Protestant and a Catholic was. But I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and that led me fairly directly into the Catholic Church. I will tell one story. I could talk for hours, as some of you could, about your witness testimony and what brought you into the proper relationship to the Catholic faith and to God and so forth. But I want to tell one story, because it has a lot to do with my crossing the fence between Judaism and Christianity. Because I was still, even after this experience of Mary, it sounds ridiculous, but I was still anti-Christian, and I was even more anti-Catholic. And I kind of had to be dragged kicking and screaming into the Catholic Church for a while. So what happened was, because I was in love with Mary, let me say something. After this experience, next morning when I woke up, my first thought was, oh, good, I can't wait to go to sleep again tonight and see her again. And it never occurred to me that it would never happen again. And then so it didn't happen that night. So the next morning when I woke up, I said, well, at least it's going to happen at least once a week, right? And then it didn't, and then at least once a month. And by the time I realized it would never happen again, the experience had faded enough so that I could face life without expecting it to happen again. But if the next morning when I woke up after this experience, somebody had told me, you're going to have to live 70 years on Earth before you ever see her again, I just could not have handled it. There was no way I could have supported that thought. It was grace that by the time I realized it would never happen again, I had kind of, it had faded enough so that I could face, waiting to see her again. But anyway, so I was still anti-Christian and anti-Catholic, but I was spending all my time at Marian shrines just to feel her presence and kind of commune with her. And there was a Marian shrine near my house to Our Lady of La Salette, which was an apparition high in the French Alps in 1846, church approved, where it's a little bit like Fatima. Mary appeared. It was one time apparition, but she appeared to two shepherd children with a message, calling on people to convert. And so I was driving up there 3 or 4 days a week just to be there. And then the following winter, I went skiing in the French Alps, and it was raining, so I decided to take a day off and go to the real Our Lady of La Salette, where she appeared, which is very beautiful. It's, It's in the middle of, way above tree line. It's about 10 miles from the nearest village, under these huge granite cliffs and glaciers and just in this very high mountain wilderness. It's at about 3,200 meters, that kind of thing. It's about 10,000 feet up. And, I'm meandering. I'm sorry. So let me come down from the mountain. But so I went up there. I thought I would only go up there for a day, but a blizzard started. The rain that was there and where I was skiing was snow up there, and I got stuck up there for the whole ski trip. And so by the time I got off the mountain, it was time to fly home, and I got to Geneva, and I was taking the plane the next morning. And the night before the plane, I went to sleep on a friend's couch in Geneva. And I kind of said a prayer before going to sleep, which was really a complaint. I just kind of whined to God, I can't believe you did this to me. I go halfway around the world to go skiing, and you stick me at La Salette for the whole time. And so I go to sleep, and I wake into this dream where I'm confronted with this very serious but loving man. It reminded me of like a teacher in high school who's always very stern, but all the kids know he really loves them more than, you know, the happy clappy teachers. And he just like drilled me with his eyes, and he said, you can go skiing or you can work for the second coming. It's your choice. Which do you choose? So anyway, I felt about 2 inches tall, and I got the message. And I'll talk about that too, but there's a huge connection between the conversion of the Jews and the second coming, which I'll talk about later this weekend. But what I had wanted to say was, when I was at La Salette, I met a French woman, another pilgrim there, who told me that she thought it would be a good idea if I visit the Carthusians. And she told me a little about the Carthusians. They're the most severe contemplative order left in the church. They live in total silence. They live in solitary confinement, essentially. And they never sleep for more than about 3 hours at a time. They break sleep every night from about midnight to 2:30 to say the office matins in the chapel and so forth. And so when she told me about it, I figured, oh great, these guys got to be mystics, because if they weren't mystics, they go nuts with that life. So when I got home, I called this Carthusian monastery in France and asked if I could come visit, and they let me come visit. And when I was there, I was really struck by two things. One was, I felt how the Catholic Church is like the embodiment of the Blessed Virgin Mary. I just felt the identity between the presence of the Virgin Mary and the Catholic Church, and that was inescapable. Another thing that I noticed was, I would have thought that these monks would have been sort of embittered and dried out, and, you know, because they had such a sterile penitential life. And instead, they were like, happy kindergarten children sharing a joke, you know, walking around with these kind of inner lit up grins all the time. And I knew that was because, rather than being a kind of sterile environment without any feminine presence, it had a very strong feminine presence, which was the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I joined them in their prayer, you know, from midnight to 2:30 a.m. in the chapel. And so I'm surrounded by all these elderly monks droning on for hours, you know, and what they're doing is they're chanting the Psalms, right? So they're chanting, you know, oh, Jerusalem, should I ever forget you? Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. And, you know, all these Psalms about Zion and Israel and everything. And so I'm looking around at them, and I say to myself, these guys are all wannabe Jews. And then finally, because they're not allowed to talk, sometimes they take advantage to bend the rules a little bit and talk. And I was out in the orchards cutting the grass one day when one of these elderly monks shuffles out to me and says, do you mind if I ask you a question? And I say, no. And he says, well, if you don't mind, you're not Catholic, are you? Because we noticed you weren't taking communion. And I said, no, that's right, I'm not Catholic. And he said, well, then, if you don't mind us asking, what are you? And I said, I'm Jewish. And he said, oh, that's a relief. We were all afraid you were Protestant. So that also kind of opened my eyes, because, of course, they saw the continuity, and they felt that they were like adopted Jews, right? Because that's the case in some sense with the Catholic Church, and I'll talk about that more. But Saint Paul says that, you know, that the Church is children of Abraham by adoption. And so they felt this identity or this continuation with the Jews, whereas Protestants had left the Catholic Church, so they had a very different relationship to that. So by the time I got home, I was much less anti-Catholic. I understood the identity or the presence of the Blessed Virgin Mary in the Catholic Church. I understood the positive presence of Judaism in the Catholic Church. And so, so by then I was kind of on my way to accepting becoming Catholic. And I almost think I should stop then. It's 9:15. Maybe I'll and it's late. I think I will stop. I think I'll wait with a heavy theology. Start fresh tomorrow morning with a more heavy theology. I don't know if anyone has a lighthearted question. Yeah?
The time happened from when you had the experience walking under the pine trees by the sea.
Yeah.
And then when you had the experience with our Blessed Mother.
It was exactly a year to the day. Exactly a year to the day. It was on the 1 year anniversary. Yeah. Yeah. What was the stupid question? I'll tell you. Guys, this is not being recorded, I think. It doesn't really matter, but this was all totally new to me. And a few weeks earlier, a friend at work, I was driving with him somewhere, and he got one of these, he was subscribed to one of these kind of new agey science magazines. And it had a photograph of the satellite that orbited Mars, took a picture of the surface of Mars, and there was a mountain range that looked exactly like a man's face. It's a great picture. I actually have it on my computer so I can make it available. But it really does. It's exactly it's got to do with the light and the shadows and things, but it looks exactly like a portrait of a man's face. Or sculpture of a man's face. So I asked the Virgin Mary, what was that about? So anyway, it was a pretty dumb question, and I did not get a real answer. So. No, she was very gracious. She was very gracious, and she just like kind of. It's sort of like when she said, I love all prayers to me. She gave sideways answers.
Motherly answers.
Yeah. Since then, she's become much sterner with me. I don't know if you have that experience, but she's no pushover. I'll tell this, too, just because, this is such a lighthearted move. I had a lot. I mean, in other words, in the beginning of this, because of, what I was supposed to do and stuff, I actually had a lot of experience of her. And I was getting up every morning at like 3 to pray for a couple of hours. And I complained, I didn't like it. And she said to me, what's the big deal? You can go back to sleep afterwards. I mean, that's the way she kind of was to me. Sort of stop complaining. What's the big deal? You can go sleep afterwards. So anyway, she was kind of strict with me, but I needed it, I guess. So, yeah?
Did you share any of your experiences with family or friends?
That was disastrous. When I came back from that first experience, my mother, as I said, she was actually arrested by the Gestapo and en route to a concentration camp. She had a horrible experience in the context of escaping. And it really made her afraid to believe in God. And anyway, so she was very, like, depressed all her life. And so I thought, great. I called her as soon as I got home and said, Mom, I got good news for you. It's all true. You know, we live forever. You know, God really exists. And it never occurred to me she wouldn't believe me because this experience had been so real. It's like, you know, I'm an eyewitness. And I never anticipated her response, which was just this like awkward silence on the phone because she just thought I had gone nuts. And that's the only, okay. So I had tried to share it. I mean, I didn't try with my family after that. I did try with, friends a little bit. And because of the presence of the New Age and stuff, you know, I got a little bit of a sympathetic response from friends, but they just put it in the kind of bucket of, you know, New Age weirdness. So, and I didn't tell anyone my witness testimony for probably 20 years after this happened. It's very odd. But it was actually at a Youth 2000. It was the first time I did. But it was like I wasn't supposed to, and then all of a sudden I was supposed to, and then I started talking about it. So, yeah.
Have you shared your experiences with other people since then?
Yes, I have, and it's a great joy. And I don't know if you know Marino Restrepo, for instance, but I just was with him last week. And, yeah, it's a lot of fun because I know, you know what I mean? There's a common aspect to the experience. And so when he's talking about, I know from the inside what he's talking about. When I had that experience, walking in nature the first time, it was really, neat because it was like I had a searchlight on my forehead and I could not ask myself a question without being given the answer. I could not frame a theological question in my mind about, you know, God or life or anything without the answer being shown to me. And, when I first either read or heard of Marino's experience in the cave, you know, I knew that it was the same thing, that kind of intellectual vision where you're just taught, but you're taught by being shown all of these theological truths. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I had a little flash, not really, but I've had a couple of little flashes, like when I left the Carthusian monastery. I had a little momentary flashback of that, so to speak, and actually once when I left another monastery, you know, after a week's retreat or whatever, there was a little echo of that consciousness. What did the Virgin Mary look like? Actually, you know something? She looked a lot like that picture that's in my room. I don't know if it's in everyone's room, of the statue in what's it called? Tiolina. Yeah. And she, which is also a lot like the image that's associated with the you know, with Fatima, of her heart surrounded by thorns. It was quite a triangular face with a narrow chin and a small mouth and needless to say, very delicate features. Yeah.
What language did she speak to you? When you were growing up, did you speak Hebrew?
No, I didn't. I spoke English with a German accent, by the way. But she spoke English, and much of what she said, everything that I recounted of her saying was spoken, but there were also things that were just placed in my mind as knowledge while she was speaking. So for instance, when she recited that prayer in Portuguese, I knew without being told that she was saying it in Portuguese because the Portuguese people still held on to a certain Marian devotion and like childlike trust in Mary more than others. And so in saying it in Portuguese, she was carrying that sentiment along with the words and stuff like that. So there were things that were just, I don't know what you call it, but just knowledge placed in my mind in addition to the words. But the words were in English. Yeah?
As you're still Jewish?
I consider myself still Jewish, yeah.
Still hold Sabbath practices like the Sabbath?
I really believe in the Catholic Church. So all of the first Catholics were Jews before they were Catholic, right? I have a prayer card that actually I have enough for all of you, but I had it made up. It says some Catholic Jews, Jesus, Mary, St. Peter, St. Paul. Right? They were all Jews, right? The early church, I mean, the 3,000 on Pentecost Sunday that, when Peter preached and they all entered the church, they were all Jews. So these questions are not new questions. These were really addressed. They were really critical questions 2,000 years ago because the whole church, I mean, the first wave into the church were Jews, and of course Jesus was Jewish and all the apostles were Jewish. So I don't think I have to figure out whether I'm supposed to keep Saturday as a Sabbath or Sunday as a Sabbath. This was like a real crisis in the first decades, and they really figured it out, and I really believe, the judgment of the church on those things. So I think it's a terrible error when Jews become Christian today to think like they're the first Jews to become Christian and they have to figure this out from ground zero. That's ridiculous. It's what the first church councils were all about. So if you buy the scriptures, the New Testament, these questions are all resolved in the New Testament. And if you buy the Catholic Church, these questions are all resolved by dogma. So the answer is I have no ambiguity in my heart about whether I'm still supposed to keep kosher or whether I'm supposed to keep the Sabbath. Not at all. Now, I do pray the Jewish holidays, but I pray the Jewish holidays out of my yearning to share the wealth with my Jewish brethren. In other words, my heart goes out to them for what they're missing. And so I find myself praying on the Jewish holidays, but essentially praying for their conversion, praying for them to have the grace of knowing the fulfillment of Judaism. But I don't follow Judaism as though, I don't know how to put it, but in any sense, instead of Catholicism. I will say it's a little bit of a digression, but and don't mean to put you on the spot. But I'll put you on the spot. What was the crisis that caused the first church council? What did they have to decide at the first church council? Circumcision. Yeah, it was 50 AD. But circumcision was really just an example of the question. The bigger question was, are we allowed to let Gentiles into the church, or is the church only for Jews? Now, if it was only for Jews, then of course Gentiles who wanted to enter the church would have to be circumcised because they would have to enter Judaism before they qualified for entry into the church. So that was really the question. The early church was so Jewish that the question was, is it available to non-Jews? So everything that the early church defined was in relationship, in some sense, to Judaism. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much.